Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the program. As listeners know, this program is about ideology, Marxism, Leninism, or communism, and American Marxism, a derivative. My goal for each program is to educate Americans and the people of the world about the realities of communism by examining and critiquing the ideology. In this episode, I'm going to talk about the Chinese Communist Party's ideological and institutional inferiority. Ideology is about ideas, and in world affairs, ideas matter. In communist states, it is communist ideas and not a supreme leader's personality cult that is the most important in identifying the goals and objectives of the regime. This is most striking in the People's Republic of China. This episode is based on an analysis of the role of Chinese communist ideology in China that was done by Miles Yu, the former State Department policy planning official for China. Miles, as many listeners know, is perhaps the premier academic in America who understands the nature of communism and its role in China today. While many pro-communist sympathizers insist China's regime is not really communist and that Marxist-Leninist ideology is merely a cloak worn by its leaders, the reality is different. All Chinese communist chiefs, from Mao Zedong through Deng Xiaoping, from Jiang Zemin and Hu Jintao through Xi Jinping, the current leader, adhered to two fundamental ideas they claim are sacred and self-evident. Number one is that the ruling Chinese Communist Party is infallible. Second, party leaders insist the Marxist-Leninist socialist system of governance is superior to every alternative. This false sense of superiority is behind the current Chinese communist drive to one day dominate the world. This ideological consistency by all CCP leaders, regardless of various differences held by each, is remarkable. All vigorously promote two fundamental tenets, often in ways that have brought death and devastation to China's people. First, Mao declared in 1954, and all his successors to date have proclaimed it as an absolute ideological shibboleth of the party state. Quote, "The core force that must lead our cause is the Chinese Communist Party. The theoretical foundation that must guide our thinking is Marxism-Leninism," end quote. This communist ideological fanaticism is the main source of the CCP leader's conduct. Anyone who openly challenges this supposition faces severe punishment, long prison or labor camp internment, or worse, torture or execution. In a bid to bolster its false claims of infallibility and superiority, the CCP promotes propaganda and indoctrination that is needed to prevent the ideology from collapsing under the weight of its false premises. Thus, the CCP, since seizing power in 1949, launched multiple ideologically driven political movements and indoctrination campaigns to sustain these fictions. All governance matters, be they economic, public health issues, disaster response, cultural and or entertainment matters, educational initiatives, sports programs, or, as the world has witnessed, epidemics, are turned into mass political movements with whole nation mobilizations by the CCP. These mobilizations are meant to showcase the infallibility of the Chinese Communist Party and the superiority of their monopoly of power. The result of advancing these communist tenets has been a calamity for China and the Chinese people. Hundreds of millions of Chinese perished, and hundreds of millions more continue to suffer under CCP inhuman policies and actions. Mao enacted a murderous land reform and urban collectivization program under the Marxist idea that private ownership under the capitalist system must be destroyed and replaced with communist state controls. Utopian communism propelled Mao to launch what was called the Counter-Revolutionaries Liquidation Campaign, the disastrous Great Leap Forward, and the nation-destroying Cultural Revolution. Moving ahead under Deng Xiaoping, Mao's successor, the four cardinal principles of Marxist-Leninist dictatorship were enshrined. Deng conducted the bloody anti-spiritual pollution campaign and, of course, the Tiananmen massacre involving People's Liberation Army tanks and troops that brutally crushed masses of pro-democracy Chinese protesters in Beijing's central square. Following Deng, Jiang Zemin and later Hu Jintao worked to strengthen the dictatorship of the proletariat in China. That was the precursor to the mass surveillance state and Orwellian high-tech totalitarian repression now in place in China and being exported by Chinese communists worldwide. Current Supreme Leader Xi Jinping today is advancing the CCP's dictatorship to its logical conclusion, perfecting a communist model of governance decades in the making, from Xinjiang to Hong Kong to every city in between. Communist control can be seen in the draconian enforcement of the CCP's zero COVID policy. This control mechanism under the guise of public health is an example of one of the many CCP mass movements carried out under the ironclad commitment to communism. Security forces in biohazard suits were filmed brutally enforcing the mass CCP crackdown, the zero COVID policy, forced quarantines. We saw that in Shanghai. If the party is deemed omnipotent and infallible, and the socialist system is declared infinitely superior to the U.S.-led free market and democratic system, then this pretext gives CCP General Secretary Xi Jinping unchecked state power and resources under his command to sustain the myth that not a single case of COVID can be allowed to withstand the power of the Communist Party. What Xi has proven to the entire world, however, is the opposite. The Chinese Communist Party's monopoly on power and ideological mobilization is an abject failure. Socialism is undeniably inferior to the democratic system of freedom and human rights. The more than 1 million Uyghurs condemned to concentration camps, the Tibetan Buddhists who set themselves on fire to protest brutal communist rule, the pro-democracy activists from Hong Kong now languishing in prison camps, and most of the Chinese people would no doubt agree with this. Today, under Xi, China is facing mounting problems, both at home and abroad, and significantly, the grievances and anger of the Chinese people are on the rise. Some analysts place the blame on Xi himself, an obstinate, arrogant, incompetent, and insistent leader who has been micromanaging everything. Some foreign observers also fault Xi for the crackdown and dictatorial controls put in place in China that are more stringent than those of earlier leaders. Thus, these analysts incorrectly assess that Xi, and not Chinese communism, is the ultimate problem. They also mistakenly believe China will be better off and the CCP less threatening to freedom, democracy, and world peace by merely replacing Xi. It is true that Xi is a poor leader, but he is not the root cause of the problem. The main source of China's sorrow and antagonism toward the free world is the communist ideological system of governance. The communist system itself created political leaders like Xi, and before him, Mao and Deng. Their worldviews and their policies uniformly are conditioned by the same ideological tenets. Just like Xi, Mao, Deng, Zhang, Hu were Marxist-Leninists who did not hesitate to inflict massive loss of human life and individual dignity, whether in Tibet, Xinjiang, Tiananmen, or Shanghai. Xi jettisoned the Deng policy that saw China hide its capabilities and bide its time while building power. Xi Jinping, through his China dream that I call the China nightmare, wants to produce something he believes will convince the non-communist world to accept the true ideological and political contours of the CCP regime. Now, one positive aspect of Xi Jinping's drive to revive Chinese communism is that the free world is gaining new clarity about the evil nature of the Chinese communist system. That recognition is long overdue, but much more education is needed for Western policy and political elites, including many who have been influenced and controlled by the CCP through decades of deception. Quote, Xi's brazenness and ideological clarity are essential factors in reversing U.S. policy towards China in recent years, said Miles Yu, who was played a historical key role in the Trump administration in reversing pro-appeasement policies that for decades had misled the United States and many other Western states. Also, Xi Jinping's brazen return to Marxist-Leninist rule also has made the Chinese political system and the CCP's stranglehold on power more fragile. This represents a strategic vulnerability and has revealed evidence that power has rendered the CCP arrogant, corrupt, and ignorant. Arrogance of power is a fundamental trait of the Chinese Communist political system, a hubris that has given the CCP power unrestrained by any other force, check, or balance. The most recent case of CCP arrogance was the mishandling of the COVID pandemic. This major public health crisis should have been addressed using science and medical measures with care and balance for human dignity and individual freedom. Yet since day one of the outbreak in Wuhan, Chinese Communist authorities made clear they had no intention of adopting scientific and balanced measures. Instead, the CCP politicized the pandemic, ordering lockdowns and cover-ups with little regard for whether people would live or die, and suppressing and silencing doctors, journalists, and other knowledgeable people who spoke up. Some aspects of this approach were indirectly adopted by American health authorities. The result was devastating damage to the U.S. economy through lockdowns and authoritarian controls that did little to stem the tide of the epidemic. All measures implemented by the Chinese Communist Party in response to the pandemic were designed not for public health, but first and foremost to protect the party's myth of infallibility and its supposed all-around greatness. The policies all were intended to prove the superiority of the communist system, which all power has concentrated in the ruling party. Precisely because of party arrogance and unchecked power, the false notion was put forth that the virus could not spread throughout the country. In a similar vein to Mao's belief that the party could kill all sparrows in China in the late 50s because they ate grain, Xi believes the party can kill every single coronavirus in China. The results in both cases were devastating. To demonstrate the CCP's omnipotence, to prove the absolute efficiency of the socialist system of centralized power, a nation of 1.3 billion people was forced to bend to the will of one man, equipped solely with a doctorate in so-called scientific socialism, who professes to be the guardian of authentic communist fundamentalism. CCP arrogance of power can also be seen in its foreign policy. Every nation bordering China has either been bullied, provoked by the CCP in recent history, or is deeply suspicious of its giant neighbor. China today has no true allies in the world. When the CCP felt its national strength was insufficient to achieve its aim, the leadership decided to, quote, hide and bide, that is, hide our capabilities and bide our time. The policy was couched as peaceful coexistence. But now the CCP feels self-assured, and that it is time to stretch its wings. So the regime in Beijing is resorting to great power diplomacy. For the CCP, this means the same kind of megalomania that is more frequently seen in its domestic policy, and it is now being applied to its foreign policies. Recent war games surrounding Taiwan demonstrated clearly that the CCP is no longer committed to peaceful reunification with the island state. The missile firings, warship activities, and provocative warplane flights now clearly show the CCP was practicing for military action to forcibly take over Taiwan. For the CCP, arrogant power also becomes corrupt power, and corruption within the Chinese regime is rampant and institutionalized. Power's tendency to corrupt also made the Chinese Communists' ideological and institutional commitments fragile. It threatens the collapse of the system, and it is spiritually corrosive. Recent news reports investigating CCP corruption revealed that families of senior communist officials, including the country's supreme leader and its premier, are fabulously wealthy, with billions squirreled away in places like Hong Kong. This corruption is a feature of every level of the party state. The CCP has over 2,000 senior cadres at the provincial and ministerial levels throughout China. Since the 18th Party Congress in 2012, the year Xi Jinping ascended to supremacy, more than 230 CCP officials were arrested for corruption and other crimes, a crime rate more than 10 times that of the population as a whole. Corruption is even more rife among grassroots communist cadres. The Chinese Communist Party is also failing due to the level of ignorance that a monopolistic hold on power breeds in those in charge. An arrogant, corrupt regime is incapable of governing a country with correct and sage policy recommendations or prescriptions. Under CCP controls, the supreme leader is considered all-knowing and all-powerful. He is always regarded as the genius, a master strategist. Xi has been labeled the core of the party. His dictates cannot be questioned. The slightest dissent is met with severe punishment, and too often transgressors suddenly disappear into oblivion, becoming non-persons. From Mao to Deng and now Xi, the Chinese Communist Party system has produced prolonged and astonishing levels of ignorance in party leaders. Political campaigns to kill sparrows and professors is asinine. Backyard steel furnaces of the Great Leap are stupid. Building aircraft carriers without capable offensive air wings is ridiculous. But over the last several years, Chinese leaders' ignorance has only increased. Ill-conceived policy measures such as zero COVID are portrayed as flashes of brilliance in Chinese propaganda outlets, but the ignorance and incompetence of senior communist officials are the butt of jokes among the Chinese and the people of the world in international forums, with people sighing at the folly of it all. The decline in the Chinese economy, bank runs, and misery and tragedy of the COVID lockdowns prove the absurdity of the belief that the Chinese communist ideological system is better at dealing with the pandemic than democratic systems. It is not. Those who believe in the superiority of the Chinese communist system point to China's economic growth. The Beijing propaganda machine often refers to the party's leadership and socialism superiority as the reason for the economic prosperity. But this is false and absurd. There's no doubt China has grown greatly in power, especially over the last 15 years or so, including the rapid economic and military development. But even Chinese state statistics show that nearly half the entire population of 1.3 billion people live on under $5 a day. And this is contrary to official CCP announcements that, quote, all poverty in China has been eliminated. This is not prosperity by any stretch of the imagination. In reality, China's economic development is the result of the enormous growth of wealth created by the Chinese people's liberation from the Communist Party-controlled and planned economy, and the opportunities offered by the international free market system. The wealth created by the Chinese working people has been arbitrarily stolen from them and exploited by the monopolistic communist state. This state system has lined the pockets and developed the military power of the party and its 95 million members. But that kind of economic progress is not sustainable. It is without institutional logic. Furthermore, due to the CCP's intransigence and its predatory economic policies, opportunities provided by the free market system are being closed off to the regime. The illusion of Pax Sinica is evaporating. Current Chinese communist rule under Xi Jinping cannot stand up to the challenges of a democratic and free system throughout the world. In fact, precisely because of China's institutional inferiority, the regime is in reality weak and constantly in a state of fear. Fear of being subverted by its own people at any moment, fear of being told by the world that the party does not represent the Chinese people, and fear of the truth that China and the CCP are two different, clearly conflicted entities. CCP economic weaknesses are also reflected in the insecurity and sensitivity to international public opinion. Beijing is paranoid about the advent of a peaceful evolution influenced by international democratic forces. This paranoia has driven the CCP to enhance communist ideological indoctrination programs at home. For example, Xi has launched a nationwide campaign called Never Forget Your Initial Commitment, that is, to communism. Since vast numbers of the Chinese people believe communism is a bankrupt ideology, the CCP is becoming desperate. Currently, about 2,500 universities and colleges operate throughout China, but there are nearly twice as many CCP party schools. These institutions' sole mission is to train ideologically committed communist cadres at local, provincial, and state levels. The ideology they are teaching is a false anti-capitalist ideology that relies on force and deception. It must be exposed and countered through programs like this that stress education and presenting the facts about communism. General Secretary Xi has forced China to suffer from an intense indoctrination campaign to bolster the CCP's four confidences in socialism, communism, party monopoly on political power, and socialist culture. And he has pushed CCP's notorious wolf warrior diplomacy, anti-US and anti-democratic diplomacy abroad. None of these measures can hide the falsity and fragility of the CCP's ideology and institution. For example, a single tweet by a U.S. professional sports manager supporting pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong caused a major political spasm in the, quote, great power of Beijing. Another case of inferiority can be seen in how state censors are employing all tools at their disposal to protect Xi Jinping from comparisons to the A.A. Milne character Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh is now banned and censored in China because of this. The German philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel said more than 200 years ago that some Asian authoritarian societies represented by a dynastic China had actually remained in the infancy of civilizational development and had not yet matured. Popular Chinese folklore often compared the CCP to a giant infant baby locked in a powerful body without a mature, developed brain and the rationality of an adult. But even Hegel would never have expected a giant baby in the infancy of civilizational development to have the ambition to dominate the world. This is a communist internationale that must not be allowed to happen. By understanding that ideas matter and that the ideas of Marxism-Leninism are the sources of CCP's conduct, we can better understand their behavior, their vulnerabilities, and how to secure freedom now and in the future. As the late foreign policy and strategic affairs expert Konstantin Menges put it, the solution to the threat from China is to tell the truth about its communist system and its leaders. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File. That's GertzFile.com or at the book site called DeceivingTheSky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to gofundme.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to gofundme.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the show. In this, the counterproposal section of the program, what I call the spiritual part, I'm going to be discussing a new understanding about the nature of God. The point of the counterproposal here is to provide a counter-ideology to communism, which I have explained very clearly. Marxist and communist ideology is based at its core on the false assumption there is no God. Thus, humans are not regarded as spiritual beings, but simply another animal life form. What I'm presenting here is based on the divine principle of the late Reverend Sun Myung-moon, a true modern-day prophet who learned firsthand about the horrors of communism during his imprisonment in a North Korean prison labor camp for preaching the Word of God. He was freed by United Nations troop led by General Douglas MacArthur during the Korean War. In this episode, I'm going to talk about Chapter 1 called The Principle of Creation. This principle helps answer fundamental questions about human life and the universe, something that throughout history people have anguished over without having satisfying answers. And the principle of creation provides stark truth to the false answers to these questions Marxists and communists have used to promote the anti-Christian and anti-God ideology of communism. The reason there is confusion about the fundamental questions of life is that until recently, few understood the root principle by which humanity and the universe were originally created. Problems concerning human life and the universe will not be solved without first understanding the nature of God. So what are God's characteristics? They are dual characteristics. How can we know the divine nature of the invisible God? One way to fathom his deity is by observing the universe he created. Thus St. Paul said in Romans 1:20, "Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made." Just as a work of art displays the invisible nature of its maker in a concrete form, everything in the created universe is a substantial manifestation of some quality of the Creator's invisible divine nature. As such, each stands in a relationship to God. Just as we can come to know the character of an artist through his works, so we can understand the nature of God by observing the diverse things of creation. First, let's look at the common elements found universally throughout the natural world. Every entity possesses dual characteristics of what have, in the Orient, have been called yang, or masculinity, and yin, femininity. All things of creation come into existence only when these characteristics have formed reciprocal relationships, both within the entity and between the entities and other entities. For example, subatomic particles, the basic building blocks of all matter, possess either a positive charge or a negative charge, or a neutral charge formed by the neutralization of positive and negative constituents. Atoms have positive and negative duality. When these dual characteristics within one atom enter into reciprocal relationships with those of another atom, they form molecules. Molecules engage in reciprocal relationships between their dual characteristics to eventually become nourishment fit for consumption by plants and animals. Plants propagate by means of stamen and pistil. Animals multiply and maintain their species through the relationship between males and females. According to the Bible, after God created Adam, he saw that it was not good for man to live alone. Only after God created Eve as Adam's female counterpart did he declare that his creations were very good in Genesis 1:31. Similarly, each animal, whether male or female, maintains its life through the reciprocal relationships of yang and yin elements within itself. The same holds true for every plant. Moreover, every creation exists with correlative aspects, inside and outside, internal and external, front and rear, right and left, up and down, high and low, strong, weak, rising and falling, long and short, wide and narrow, east and west, north and south, etc. The reason for this is that everything is created to exist through reciprocal relationships of dual characteristics. Thus, we can understand that everything requires for its existence a reciprocal relationship between the dual characteristics of yang and yin. However, another pair of dual characteristics in reciprocal relationship is even more fundamental to the existence than the dual characteristics of yang and yin. Every entity possesses both an outer form and an inner quality. The visible outer form resembles the invisible inner form quality. The inner quality, through invisible, possesses a certain structure which is manifested visibly in the outer form. Again, the inner quality is called the internal nature, and the outer form or shape is called the external form. Internal nature and external form together constitute dual characteristics. For human, a human is composed of an outer form, the body, and an inner quality, the mind. The body is a visible reflection of the invisible mind. Because the mind possesses a certain structure, the body which reflects it also takes on a particular appearance. All beings exist through reciprocal relationships between their dual characteristics of internal nature and external form. Within each being, the internal nature, which is causal and subject, commands the external form. This relationship allows the individual being to exist and function purposefully as a creation of God. The human mind imparts to every person a natural inclination to join with others in harmony. According to modern science, all particles that constitute atoms are made up of energy. For energy to form particles, it too must possess an internal nature which directs it to assume specific forms. Probing deeper still, the search for the ultimate cause that brought this energy with its elements of internal nature and external form into existence. This being would be the first cause of all the myriad things in the universe. As the first cause, it must also possess the dual characteristics of internal nature and external form, which stand in the position of subject partner to the internal natures and external forms of all beings. So you see, it's a constant relationship between these internal and external forms. We call this first cause of the universe God, and we call God's internal nature and external form the original internal nature and original external form. As St. Paul indicated, by investigating characteristics that are universally present in diverse things of creation, we can come to know the nature of God. God is the first cause of the universe and its subject partner, having the harmonious dual characteristics of original internal nature and original external form. Thus, it is clear that God, the first cause of all things, also exists based on the reciprocal relationship between his dual characteristics of yang and yin. The verse, "So God created man in his own image, in the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them," supports the idea that God, as the subject partner, has dual characteristics of yang and yin in perfect harmony. God's original internal nature and external form each contain the mutual relationship of original yang and yin. Yang and yin thus have the following mutual relationships. It's internal and external, cause and result, subject partner and object partner, and vertical and horizontal. A human being attains perfection when he centers his life on his mind. Likewise, the creation becomes complete only when God stands as its center. Hence, the universe is a perfect organic body that moves only according to God's purpose of creation. As one organic body, the universe should exist in a relationship of internal nature and external form, with God as the internal nature and the created universe as the external form. For this reason, it's written in the Bible that humans who are at the center of the universe are created in the image of God. All of this can be seen in the Bible verse that says, "Man is in the image and glory of God." In recognition of God's position as the internal and masculine subject matter, we call him our Father. In summary, God is the subject in whom the dual characteristics of original internal nature and original external form are in perfect harmony. At the same time, God is the harmonious union of masculinity and femininity, which is manifest in the qualities of original internal nature and original external form, respectively. In relation to the universe, God is a subject partner, having the qualities of internal nature and masculinity. God exists as the incorporeal subject partner to all things. In light of our understanding of the dual characteristics, the relationship between God and the universe can be summarized thus. The universe as a whole is a substantial object partner to God. It is composed of individual embodiments of truth, each a unique manifestation of the dual characteristics of God at either the level of image or of symbol, as governed by the principle of creation. The relationship between God and the universe is similar to that between internal nature and external form. It is a mutual relationship like that between dual characteristics, internal and external, cause and result, vertical and horizontal, subject partner and object partner, and so forth. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File. That's GertzFile.com, or at the book site called DeceivingTheSky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the show. This is the news section of the podcast where I discuss recent Chinese communist activities. For this episode, I'm going to talk about the recently concluded large-scale military exercises near Taiwan that were carried out by the People's Liberation Army in early August. The war games were the largest joint military exercises ever held by the PLA and included at least a dozen missile firings that landed in areas around the self-ruled island of Taiwan. Pentagon Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Cao said the roughly dozen Chinese missiles fired during the exercises to protest a visit to Taiwan by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had bracketed the island. Call, the senior policy official, said China manufactured the crisis over the Pelosi visit by conducting these large-scale military exercises near the island. Taiwan said the war games were a rehearsal for an attack on Taiwan. The defense ministry said on Twitter that 10 PLA warships, 45 warplanes were detected around the island during the height of the exercises. This prompted responses from Taiwanese interceptor aircraft, naval vessels, and placing land-based missiles on alert. The PLA continued to hold exercises for a second congressional delegation that was led by Congressman Markey from Massachusetts. And again, there were large numbers of warships and large airplane incursions. What was different was that the airplanes crossed over the median line separating the 100-mile strait Taiwan Strait between the mainland and Taiwan. This was a major escalation of Chinese military provocation. The military drills were carried out in six locations in all around Taiwan. The size, area, and complexity of the drills reflected months of planning, and expanded aircraft involving were likely addition to the Chinese air forces. The exercises had two goals. One is to intimidate Taiwan and warn Japan and the United States not to aid Taiwan in a conflict, and to rehearse key elements of the Chinese war plan for a future conflict against Taiwan. Retired Navy Captain Carl Schuster, former director of operations at the Pacific Command's Joint Intelligence Center in Hawaii, said, quote, "The exercises mark the largest PLA air missile maritime exercise ever conducted. At its peak, the military demonstration included 14 warships and 59 aircraft, including 20 jets that crossed the median line. A nuclear attack submarine also took part in supporting the aircraft carrier task force led by the carrier Shandong. 11 missiles were fired from three PLA strategic rocket forces brigades. Three of the missiles, interestingly, passed over Taiwan, and two missiles landed inside the Japanese economic exclusion zone around 50 miles from Japan's southernmost islands. The missile launches prompted a halt in aircraft flights and shipping in the area. These missile firings were highly provocative and were intended to signal Japan that the PLA plans to conduct attacks on Japan during any future assault on Taiwan. Japan and Australia, the governments of both, have announced officially and unofficially that their armed forces would join the U.S. military defense of Taiwan. Also, key U.S. military bases in Japan, including Yokota Air Base in central Japan and Yokosuka Naval Base in the southern part, are key military points that would be involved in any future defense of Taiwan, and these would likely be targets of Chinese missile strikes. President Biden, too, has announced on three occasions that the U.S. is set to militarily defend Taiwan, only to have his statements walked back by White House officials who said that the U.S. policy towards Taiwan remains unchanged, that is, that it's ambiguous. This U.S. ambiguous, unclear policy towards Taiwan, it says that the status of the island remains unresolved since the civil war in China from the 1940s that saw the communists drive the nationalists from the mainland to Taiwan. The Kuomintang, or Nationalist Party, still holds that it and not the CCP is the legitimate power in China. But on Taiwan, the pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party has been in power for many years, and the DPP seeks an identity as a free and democratic Taiwan. The CCP, meanwhile, is stepping up its rhetoric and actions that have undermined the status quo across the strait that has kept the peace for 60 years. The latest Chinese exercises also served as a practice blockade of the island, using both land attack and anti-ship missile targeting, along with a battalion-sized amphibious assault operation along the Chinese coast opposite Taiwan. A large number of military drones were also used to penetrate offshore Taiwanese islands and the northwest and southwest corners of Taiwan's air defense zone. The Taiwan Ministry of Defense and other government networks also came under cyber attacks during the war games. This indicates that China plans to use cyber attacks as part of its attack on Taiwan. So overall, the exercise provided insights into China's potential courses of action and preferences in a Sino-Taiwan conflict. The war game suggests Beijing would first isolate Taiwan and resort to air and missile strikes in hopes of breaking Taipei's political will. A costly invasion of the island is probably a last resort. So the exercise and the missile firings also showed the PLA is improving its ability to conduct joint operations. This has been a past weakness of the PLA. They have not been able to do this very difficult combined arms warfare, which requires integrating your air forces, your naval forces, and your ground forces into one powerful punch. They showed that the PLA has made incremental steps, but they represent an enduring commitment to mastering joint operations. The PLA avoided sending some of its newer J-20 fighters or Russian-made Su-35 jets. This was probably to deny Taiwan and Western intelligence agencies a close look at the aircraft. The exercise really marks the latest escalation in China's major expanding military exercise and Taiwan intimidation campaign. The exercises were also carried out amid a disturbing Chinese government report issued shortly after the war games that included a renewed vow to retake Taiwan by force. The report also accused the United States of seeking to contain China in supporting the Taiwanese government and stepping up arms sales to the island. The major white paper on Taiwan, only the third produced since 1993, states that under Chinese President Xi Jinping, unspecified new steps are being taken to speed up efforts to absorb Taiwan into the communist-ruled mainland. Quote, "We will work with the greatest sincerity and exert our utmost efforts to achieve peaceful reunification," the white paper said, "but we will not renounce the use of force, and we reserve the option of taking all necessary measures." The white paper states that China will not allow the problem of Taiwan's status to, quote, "be passed down from one generation to the next." This is a sign that they are getting impatient and that plans for attacking the country are speeding up. The policy that is called One Country, Two Systems also was promoted in the Chinese white paper. And this is this was proved to be totally false in democratic-ruled Hong Kong, where the Chinese promised to allow the democratic system but abandoned that under a crackdown that began 2 years ago. The white paper China issued repeatedly states that Beijing favors peaceful reunification and is offering the island a degree of autonomy. But who could trust them? How could you trust the Chinese after they violated their agreement in one country, two systems in Hong Kong? The threat of military action overshadows the call for a non-military solution. In the white paper, it states, the use of force would be the last resort taken under compelling circumstances. We will only be forced to take drastic measures to respond to the provocation of separatist elements or external forces if they ever intervene and cross our red lines. That's from the white paper. CIA Director William Burns warned in a recent speech that Chinese Supreme Leader Xi Jinping is carefully studying the Russian military operation in Ukraine for lessons that will apply to a Chinese strike against Taiwan. I think the risks of an invasion become higher, it seems to us, the further into this decade you get, Burns said. CIA analysts say an assault on Taiwan is less a question of whether the Chinese leadership might choose some years down the road to use force to control Taiwan, but how and when they would do it. The Pentagon criticized the war games around Taiwan, but failed to outright condemn the activities or provide a stronger reassurance to the key ally in Taipei of American support. Colin Cowell, who I mentioned, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, also said it stands by its current assessment that China will not attempt to take Taiwan by force in the next 2 years, which is not reassuring considering the intelligence estimates are that it could happen by the end of the decade, which is 8 years. U.S. intelligence agencies believe China will move against the island before the end of the decade. We continue to have a one-China policy, Cole said, and we continue to object to any unilateral change in the status quo, whether that be from China or from Taiwan. So really, China's reaction was completely unnecessary. That was Colin Cowell. The show of force by the Chinese military is an attempt to coerce Taiwan and the international community. Call said the United States is not going to take the bait by the Chinese coercion, although he did not identify what the bait was. He said the war games were part of a manufactured crisis. What the PLA and Beijing's communist leaders have done is to move a step closer to forcible reunification, and they violated past promises not to undermine the status quo that has kept the peace over Taiwan for 60 years. Chinese military forces have created a new normal of more intense and intrusive military activities around Taiwan that has increased tensions sharply and increased the risk of a war. The U.S. military insists it will continue to conduct operations near China that challenge Beijing's claim to control international waters, like the Taiwan Strait. The aircraft carrier strike group led by the USS Ronald Reagan is currently conducting operations in nearby Philippine Sea. The Reagan is expected to make a pass through the Taiwan Strait in the coming days, and we'll see what happens from that, but that would be a major sign of support for the democratic government in Taiwan. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz. Featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File, that's gertzfile.com, or at the book site called deceivingthesky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to gofundme.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to gofundme.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. For the interview portion of the podcast, I'm joined now by Stu Sverk, a retired Navy captain who writes frequently on Chinese communism for Epoch Times, the newspaper. Stu, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Sure. A recent column you wrote made the point that how can you tell when a politician is lying when his lips are moving? And this is even more appropriately applied to communists. The Chinese Communist Party is promoting itself as having a whole process democracy. This is a lie. What kind of system is the Chinese Communist system?
It's a one-party system that is controlled entirely by the Chinese Communist Party. They've even had the chutzpah to kind of set it up as three branches of government similar to the U.S., interestingly enough. They've got their executive branch. That's the old political bureau or standing committee, and they've got commissions and departments underneath it that comprise the executive branch. They've got this thing called the National People's Congress, which is basically a unicameral legislature. You know, it's kind of like the U.S. Congress. They call it a Congress, but, you know, all 3,000 members are basically Chinese Communist Party members, except for there's a couple in there. You know, the Chinese maintain about 8 dinky little parties that are thoroughly penetrated by the CCP to give them an appearance of having some type of a, you know, people's democracy. But we know that's baloney. And of course, on the judiciary side of the house, you know, they got a multi-layered court system. They got a People's Supreme Court, and they've got high people's courts in every province, you know, and, you know, it all flows down to the individual municipal and rural county level. But the problem is, you know, all of these people are CCP appointees too, and there's absolutely no way that the average Chinese citizen has any way to influence the judicial system. There's no democratic means to change anything. You can't impeach a judge if he goes off the reservation. So they're basically screwed. So, you know, this notion that it's a whole process democracy where there's using the word democracy is even an affront to people like us who live in the West, who understand what a real democracy is. I mean, they don't have a democracy. There's no way you can truly participate. There's no way that the actual will of the people can be manifested in the leadership and in the government.
It's been one of the great strategic deceptions imposed on the world by the Chinese Communist Party, this notion that they're a real democratic system, when in fact there are Marxist-Leninist with Chinese characteristic systems. You've also written that China is waging hybrid war against the U.S. in its bid for world domination. And one aspect of that has been the CCP efforts to corrupt some of the U.S. political class through its United Front Work Department. Explain a little bit about that.
Well, United Front Work Department is one of the three warfares that Mao put forth back in the day. The notion of political warfare to control domestic populations and so forth. The United Front Work Department was originally focused on China itself, because the CCP was interested, of course, in gaining control and maintaining control of the political process in the country in general on mainland China. Well, they've actually, thanks to good old Xi Jinping, have expanded the mission of the United Front Work Department to focus on overseas influence. And so what they're doing is they're exporting their mechanisms of penetrating organizations in the West, particularly against their main enemy, which is the United States of America, in all sorts of forms and fashions. And they do it through corruption of individuals, corruption of our political class, leveraging like-minded people. You know, we live in a free country here in the United States, and, you know, there are all kinds of political viewpoints that are allowed. And unfortunately, we've allowed a lot of so-called communist sympathizers to kind of mushroom and grow up inside academia, Hollywood, and even our political class over the years. And these people are susceptible to being fellow travelers and to be bought and paid for with sinecures and other incentives that the Chinese communists are only too willing to apply to use to influence our decision makers and so forth. So from top to bottom in academia, we've got these Confucius Institutes that are connected to the United Front Work Department. They influence our local colleges and universities by putting forth good things about Chinese culture while insidiously slipping in, by the way, we're communist too, and our socialism with Chinese characteristics work great. And by the way, why don't you come over here? We'll set you up in Shanghai University or someplace like that, and you can help forward our cause too by influencing your peers and others in the States. I mean, that's kind of how the process works. And they're all over the place. They're in academia, like I said. They're involved in Chinese front companies that compete for research funding out of colleges and universities. It's amazing how much they are involved in subverting, penetrating, and influencing U.S. institutions and people.
Yeah, and I'd add to that there's a gross ignorance on most of the U.S. population to this. So that's one of the focuses of this podcast, is to try to educate people to the types of things they're doing. And it's really important that people understand that when they see the Confucius Institute on some college campus or even in some schools, that people understand that this is not a benign entity that's out there teaching Chinese culture and language. This is actually a stalking horse for Chinese communism, for Marxism-Leninism. That is the ultimate goal in promoting the Chinese communist theory.
Amen. If you've got a Chinese tourist, somebody on a tourist or a work visa or whatnot, somebody who's got a passport that is mainland China, red China, communist China, however you want to refer to it, that person almost invariably has a secondary motive besides what he's over here doing, and that is to collect intelligence. That is what he is tied to do. The Ministry of State Security, sends people overseas in all kinds of disciplines and innocent type situations. But yet they're all involved in intelligence collection, influence operations, and everything. So you got to know who you're talking to. You got to find out if that Chinese person, and this is not a racist thing, okay? This is an America First national security kind of situation. You got to make sure that who you're talking to is a genuine person and not an agent of the Chinese Communist Party and Red China in general.
We're talking with Stu Swerk. Stu. The CCP is also leading the world in mass surveillance, as seen in their ability to control the internet and control populations through things like the social credit system and other control mechanisms. How serious a threat is this? They seem to be exporting this through their Belt and Road Initiative to other countries in the world.
I am deathly afraid of the Chinese social control system. Mainly because we've got U.S. technology companies that are chomping at the bit to provide the technology to make it all happen. Better surveillance cameras, artificial intelligence capabilities, the ability to fingerprint and get a person's biometric characteristics into the system and integrate those in some way, and then be able to assign these social credit scores to people based on political whim and so-called Chinese communist desires, as opposed to something more democratic and open. If you frequent a given business that is not in Chinese communist favor, you'd get a negative score, and that would be added up. And what does that mean to you as a person who's being monitored inside a social control system? It means that the government can shut down your access to just about any institution, any organization, and maybe even the grocery store if it gets down to it. So I'm really concerned about it. And the fact that we've got people in the United States of America, authoritarians who have that basic influence, as part of their own personal ideology, they're actually applauding the Chinese for this and are interested in doing social control systems in the U.S., makes me extremely concerned about our future here. That's the last thing we want. You know, we don't want a 1984 George Orwell implementation where the giant federal government, central government, is controlling every aspect and monitoring everything that an individual citizen does. We don't need that. We want the freedoms that are guaranteed by our Constitution.
Yeah, and I point out, you mentioned the tech companies assisting that. You know, Google ran this Dragonfly search engine for China that was a censorship search engine. So you can see even our Western companies are assisting in this kind of problem. So hopefully they'll wake up and that cooperation will end. Last question. A lot of experts believe China is communist in name only, or not even communist at all. David Goldman at the Asia Times comes to mind. Others believe communist ideology is merely a cloak for the thuggish regime wears to keep power. On the other side, you have people like Miles Yu, the former State Department policymaker, who says all Chinese behavior domestically and internationally can be traced to Marxism-Leninism with Chinese characteristics. What's your view on this issue?
Miles Yu is right, and the rest of those clowns are wrong. And I call them clowns, too, because anybody who doesn't understand the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese communists in general is somebody who is actually enabling them. You've got to call these people out for what they are. It's a one-party state. The Chinese Communist Party rules communist China. They have mechanisms in place to monitor what their people are doing. They don't tolerate dissent. There's no way that the average person can be involved in any type of a democratic process that results in policy implementation in the country. It is a communist state in the classical sense. Now, the only difference is, you know, it's socialism with Chinese characteristics. It's the Chinese communist version of communism. Okay, they started off as with an agrarian revolution, whereas the revolution in Russia was more from a labor party proletariat point of view. Big deal. The end result is ultimately the same. You've got an oligarchy consisting of the Chinese Communist Party, a subset of the people in a given country, in this case China, and they basically run the show and tolerate no dissent. So I'll go with Miles Yu. Thank you.
We've been talking with Stu Swerk, a China expert, and who writes often. You can find his columns at the Epoch Times. Stu, thanks for your time.
Happy to have been here. I love to pontificate whenever possible.
That's it for this episode of Victory Over Communism. I'm your host, Bill Gertz. Again, look to the website, victoryovercommunism.net, to see podcasts and other information and to provide feedback. Once again, thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist, Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.